ESPN 107.3 presents Wild at Heart, bringing outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond. Wild at Heart, powered by Cowtown USA, Colton Steakhouse and Grill, J. Cook Fly Rods, The Outdoor Superstore, Shady Lanes Cabins and Motel, Advanced Performance Shooting, Missouri Trappers Association, Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, and State Farm agent Michelle Beckett. Now, here's Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome to Wild at Heart, right here on ESPN 107.3 FM in the Pulse of the Ozarks, beautiful Rolla, Missouri. I'm your host, Bill Cooper, member of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame. In the studio with me is Jerry Cook. You are over there, aren't you, Jerry?
Yeah, I'm afraid so, Bill.
Well, we've got a crowd in here today. We've got Randy Adey with us. I've known him for a long time. And Kenny Wells, they're from the Missouri Trappers Association. So we'll be talking to these guys just a little bit later in the program. But welcome to Wild at Heart. We're a bunch of red-blooded Americans who remember and cherish their outdoor heritage. We love America and support the Second Amendment. We stand for our national anthem, say please and thank you, and open doors for the ladies. We hunt, fish, trap, shoot, float, camp, and explore in God's country, the Missouri Ozarks, right out your back door, and occasionally a few points beyond. Join us each Wednesday at 4 p.m. right here on Mid-Mo, ESPN 107.3 FM, or catch us Sundays at 8 a.m. or anytime at ESPN1073.com. This segment of Wild at Heart is brought to you by J. Cook Fly Rods, custom fly rods plus everything you need for fly fishing, located in Salem, and Harvey's Alley Spring Canoe Rental, located on the crystal clear Jack's Fork River. Well, Randy Adey, buddy, I've known you for a long time.
You bet, Bill. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. He hails from down at Licking, Missouri, and it's been as long as, 25, 30 years ago, we were doing a lot of youth turkey hunting seasons together.
You bet. You bet. We've hunted turkeys together. We started out, I was telling somebody today, we started out from day one when they started the youth seasons. We were taking kids hunting, and we had a blast.
Well, not only that, but you educated a lot of kids about the outdoors over the years. And, of course, now I guess you're working on grandkids.
You bet. You bet. I've got several grandkids, and every one of them that wants to go hunting, fishing, trapping, whatever, we try and get it done.
Well, I laugh every time I look at Facebook. Lucas has got something posted with his kids. They spend a lot of time in the outdoors, don't they?
You bet. You bet. They're there all the time. You know, they've already been out fighting the seed ticks this year, squirrel hunting and everything, you know. But they've been having a blast fishing. They trout fish. It's unbelievable how good those little boys can catch trout.
Oh, I'm sure. I can tell by the voice that Grandpa's pretty proud of them.
You bet. You bet.
Well, Lucas, and I think you probably started this, Randy, many years ago, but has a call and scent company.
You bet. You bet. Yeah, we've got Bean Creek Call Company, and we make turkey calls. We've got some deer calls. We've got deer scent. All of that kind of stuff. Pretty proud of it. Luke hand stretches all the mouth calls, and I'm really proud of that mouth call line. And we've also got some real good friction calls in the line, and we've kind of added our little secrets to our doe urine and all, and you know, put some hormones and stuff in it, and I tell you, the stuff works.
Oh, I can vouch for that. I've used it for the last several years, and you know, deer season coming up pretty quick here. We're looking at bow season, man, about two weeks away, and guys are getting excited. We're going to talk about that a little bit more later in the program, but I tell you, the product that I have trouble hanging on to the most that comes from you guys is the grunt call. I take it to camp, and everybody, I could have an auction if I wanted to.
you know, that thing has worked for me great, and I mean, that is probably as authentic of actual grunt as I've ever heard. You get the little, even the little tough air at the end of it, like a buck's right there on her. You know?
Exactly. I laughed last year. I was down on Current River with Brandon Butler. He built a cabin there on Sinking Creek. Several of us were in, and I broke that call out, and Brandon immediately, I guess he wanted to beat everybody else there. We were sitting around a campfire. He just walked up and he said, "I want that." I said, "What? That's the only one I got." He said, "Well, you can get more. You have to give that one to me." So yeah. Brandon Butler, he's the executive director of Conservation Federation, by the way. So that was a good guy to put a guy, you know. And he killed a buck then, and I didn't, because he had a grunt call, and I didn't.
Well, that's real advertising.
Yeah. So I blame it on him. But boy, I did run his spot, the biggest buck I've ever seen in the Ozarks. We were hunting back in the Roger Pryor area there, and wow, a lot of square miles of wild, wild country. And I walked in there the first day and kicked up a huge buck and two more respectable bucks. Of course, that was the last time I saw them.
Yeah.
But I really think I knew they were there because a guy came in opening morning the next morning and killed the smallest of the three. So, you know, the other two were around close. If I just had a grunt call.
Yeah, you would have probably got it done.
Well, introduce your sidekick here.
This is a good friend of mine, Kenny Wells. He's a lifetime member of the Missouri Trapper Association. He's the current conservation director of the Trapper Association. He knows as much as anybody I know about trapping in general.
Well, Kenny, welcome to the show, buddy. You're running with awful rough company there.
Yeah. We've been friends for many years. And,
well, he speaks well of you, I can say that, at least.
Well, at least I've got him fooled.
Yeah, for a long time, I guess. But you've been with the Trappers Association for decades, I understand.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, can just get a little bit of history. We're always interested in history. How long has the Trappers Association been around?
Since 1958.
1958, that is a while. But you had a lot of trappers back in the 50s, didn't you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, trapping. I can remember as a kid we did some, a little bit of coon trapping and a few muskrats. We were mostly after the raccoons, but hides were worth something back then.
That's right. Well, I started when I was 10 years old, and my next birthday I'll be 70, and I've enjoyed.
I will too.
I've enjoyed the sport of trapping. It's just been a part of my life, and I've had to adjust to a few things. The Ozark National Scenic Riverways was formed in 1964 down on Current River. And it was the first scenic riverways in the United States. And in the early 80s, they wanted to do away with trapping. And we contacted our congressman, Representative Bill Emerson, and he was very helpful. And he worked with us tirelessly, getting it passed the House twice, but the Senate did not act on the bill. So sometime in the early 80s, the National Park Service decided they'd stop trapping anyway, and we had to take them to court. So we had to take the United States Department of Interior, the National Park Service, and the Ozark National Scenic Riverways, and we were successful in winning all three lawsuits, so we can still trap the Current River today on account of those efforts that all the trappers pitched in and helped.
Well, that speaks well for trappers. I'm sure that was a large populace of people, because when you take locals, that's something they've been doing ever since they've been in this part of the world. And sometimes, I think the world of the Ozark National Scenic Riverways, just like you guys do, but there have been a couple of issues that come up down there. Trapping was one, the wild horses were another, and the Park Service, I guess, had to take a step back when the locals stood up and spoke and got a little representation, you know, to help them out. But, hey, trapping is a part of our rich Missouri heritage, the heritage of the establishment of this country, and it's just difficult to sit by and watch those things go by the wayside. And Randy, you and I have said it many times, we're dinosaurs, you know. We're people that have lived in the past and enjoyed these outdoor pursuits, and boy, it's just tough. I mean, it really hurts us in the heart to see some of these things look like they're going to go away. So, hey, we've been around long enough, we're not afraid to fight the battles.
You know, I've said many times, I think our generation has seen probably some of the best years in the outdoors as far as hunting, fishing, and trapping.
Oh, absolutely. And they talk about the good old days, you know, way, way back. And there were some good old days. But, you know, we probably got more to trap, more to hunt, more to fish in the state of Missouri than at any time in our history. And part of that's largely due to the Missouri Department of Conservation. I brag on them all the time.
Same here.
Yeah, and there's a few people don't like it because I do that. But and they don't do everything right. We could, if we wanted to badmouth them, we could do that too. But I prefer to stay on the positive side. But you guys have watched the trapping scene change dramatically in your lifetime. Here you're almost 70, and he's probably 29.
But 58. I'm getting there, 58, too, Bill.
But still, in your lifetime, you've seen so much change, and I would have never ever dreamed that we'd be fighting the kind of battles that we're fighting these days. When you were a kid, would you think you would have ever these kind of issues come up?
No, I wouldn't.
But the world's a changing place, and we have to change with it, or we do bite the dust, you know.
Yes, that's true.
But we still like some good old solid values, and trapping has been a part of our family histories. And again, I like to think we're tied to American history. You know, it was trappers that settled this country.
That's exactly right, Bill. It was trappers that settled this country. And, you know, the thing is, all the sportsmen, and this is one thing everybody needs to keep in mind here, is you have to control populations, be it the deer populations or whatever, and that's what the trapping does.
Exactly, and we're going to continue that thought in the second half. Our first segment's gone already, boys. But I'm Bill Cooper, Wild at Heart. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart right here on ESPN 107.3 FM. This segment is brought to you by Cowtown USA, home of Can-Am ATVs and UTVs, and Living the Dream Outdoor Properties is not just land, it's a lifestyle, and we live it. Well, in the studio, we've got Randy Ady and Kenny Wells from the Missouri Trappers Association. And guys, we've kicked several subjects around, but you guys been trapping for a long, long time, and you know, there's just not a lot of trappers left anymore, are there, guys?
No, there's not a lot of trappers around anymore. There's a few, and that's one of the things that we need to kind of keep in mind is the fur bearers are a renewable resource. They need to be, you know, you have to control that. Before we went to break, we'd kind of started to talk about that a little bit. You know, any sportsman trapping ought to be, you know, bundled in with all the other sports stuff. You know, Jerry was talking about the otter earlier. You know, they have to be controlled because they can be devastating on your fish. Well, it's the same way with your turkeys and all that, you know, your coyotes, your bobcats, down to your skunks and raccoon can you know, tear the skunks and raccoon do a lot of damage to nests along with possums. And that's the kind of thing you don't want to get rid of everything. And, you know, trapping gets a bad name sometimes, you know, but the thing is, all of this is just kind of helping nature along, just like we do with, you know, nature's going to kill those animals, and they're going to kill them a lot harder than than we will controlling the populations, and it's the same way. If you let deer overpopulate, you know, you're going to have the same problems. You're going to have disease and stuff, and then you won't have any. And basically, that's what you have to do. You have to control the population these days.
And that's one of the most difficult things for people to understand lots of times. You and I have seen it happen in our lifetime because we've lived for a long time. But you see, annual, any population is going to have its ups and downs. It's going to reach peaks, and it's going to reach lows. But left to leave nature to nature, and it is an extremely cruel situation, because if you get deer, for example, have overpopulated and they begin to just destroy their own habitat, you watch anything starve to death. It's a long, horrible process. And, of course, usually what happens once starvation starts is the disease situation picks up. But, Randy, we've seen it in raccoons, too. They get what's a disease they get so often?
They get distemper and parvo.
Exactly. And, boy, I've seen a number of them die from those diseases. And it's not a pretty situation. I'd much rather see an animal trapped and disposed of than to have to die under those kinds of circumstances. But what has happened, you know, back in I was born in the 40s, man. In the 40s and the 50s, I can remember being in grade school, man, and over coon season, you know, we'd go out and hunt coons in the bayou right behind the house, you know. And when I was in 7th, 8th grade, we was doing that 3, 4, 5 nights a week, you know. It was real easy to go to sleep in that old schoolhouse we had, you know.
You bet.
But it was so much fun. It was a great sense of adventure for us. But, you know, back then, there were a lot more people living out on the farm than there are today. And I just thought that's what everybody did. You know, all my buddies around the countryside were doing the same thing. And, boy, if we ever have some stories that come out of those situations. None of us had very good equipment, you know. We had a long-legged tall boy with us one night. I think he's like 16 years old and still in the 8th grade, you know. He didn't do well in school, but he knew how to coon hunt. But he was poor like the rest of us, and he wore his tennis shoes coon hunting that night, and there's about 3 inches of snow on the ground. And we got wet. No, it was cold, so we built a campfire. You know, we're going to dry his tennis shoes out for him. Now, one of them fell in a campfire, and there wasn't any retrieving in it, you know. So he walked all the way home with just a sock on one foot, you know. But that's the kind of stuff we did to get out and to coon hunt and enjoy this sort of thing. And how many kids today are living that experience?
I think very few.
Very, very few.
Yeah.
And I guess what bothers me most is they don't understand or see the value, and that's not their fault. It's not their fault at all, because they're involved in what's going on around them. But how do we convey that message to them to give them any inkling of an idea about the adventure and the excitement that's going on out there? But, you know, and we're all country boys, and if we look at what's going on in the cities, you know, in the last 30 years, a child's play area has been reduced from several city blocks to his own front or backyard, if mom and dad will even let him go out and play in that area. And what'd you guys do for play when you were kids out in the country? Yeah, you're swimming in the creek, swinging from the grapevines, and did a lot of things you wouldn't want your parents to find out yet. But we all survived it, you know. And I guess we like to think we're a little bit of heroes because of that. But that's why I look up to trappers as still being, you know, heroes of this country because of the history of trapping. But is there any trapping going on now at all?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What's going on now?
You bet. Well, we've got, if anybody's interested in learning more about trapping, here in just a couple of weeks, the 13th through the 16th of September, we have our annual Missouri Trapper Association Fall Rendezvous. And there is all kinds of stuff going on there. We will have all kinds of demos where you can watch professionals. Kenny here is going to do a mink demo for us. We've got just a whole group of folks, that some of the best in the United States, is going to do demos out here. If you want to learn more about it, there'll be all kinds of supplies there. anything you need for trapping. We'll have a lot to eat there. We're going to have a fish fry on Friday night. And the
American volunteers are going to do the concessions the rest of the time. The fish fry on Friday night goes to the 9th District, which is our home district.
And where is this going to be held?
At the Commons in Salem.
Okay.
Yeah, everybody knows where the Commons is.
Yeah,
tell us where it's at.
It's on 72.
Just outside of Salem.
It's hard to miss. It's the fairgrounds, right?
It's the fairgrounds in Salem, Missouri.
Yeah. You say there's going to be all kinds of demos. How about demos on fine cigars?
No, this is all going to have to do with trapping. You can learn to trap about anything that is legal in the state of Missouri. There's going to be all kinds of demos, gray fox, beaver, the coyote. We've got some really super coyote trappers that's going to be there to do demos.
Now, you're getting into the tough animals to catch.
When
you talk about coyotes and bobcats. If you run into the guy that's trapping coyotes and bobcats, you know he's either just learning or he really knows what he's doing.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, once again, tell us the dates, the times, and where.
This will be the 13th through the 16th of September. And it's in Salem, Missouri at the Commons. That's the fairgrounds. It's just outside of Salem on 72 Highway. And, again, like I say, we're going to have all kinds of activities there. There's going to be stuff going on all day. There's even going to be a washer tournament there. And that gets
a washer
to be,
tournament.
There's going to be a washer tournament. And that really gets to be an issue there. You know, there's
heavy
a lot
competition.
Of, heavy competition, you bet.
I bet that, boy, you're striking a chord, man. I grew up close to a little country store. You know, it was so cool. I still remember some of these old guys. You know, particularly in the wintertime, they'd sit around an old coal stove and spit in the stove and play checkers and washers. They even played washers inside. They had a board made that you slid the washers across trying to get it in the holes, you know.
Yeah.
Or in the summertime, they went outside and dug holes in the ground. Now, that made it a lot tougher, the old lumpy, bumpy ground and try to get a washer. But, yeah, old-timey stuff that, we don't even hear much about anymore, but it sounds like it's going to be a grand old time down there. But, boy, we've got 2 or 3 minutes left, and I want to get back to a trapping situation again now. So what are you trapping for right now?
Well, we start on November the 15th. And it goes through, for most animals, January 31st. Then we can trap otter and muskrat till February the 28th. And then we can trap beaver till March the 31st.
Now, Kenny, I just tell by looking at you, you're an old trapper. You probably caught thousands of animals in your lifetime. And I got to ask you, what's your favorite animal to trap?
The mink.
And why?
Well, as a boy, I always wanted to catch mink. I learned from some of the best. There was an old man by the name of Bud Wright, and he was an old-time trapper. He trapped Spring Creek. And in 1939, he trapped enough mink to buy him and his wife, Laura, a new Chevrolet car.
Really?
And I just always fascinated me about the mink, so I've been fortunate enough. I've caught 54 mink 2 years in my trapping career, but I never could catch 55.
Hey, that's just the way it works sometimes, you know. But, boy, what an intriguing thing to talk about, though. I really feel like there's a piece of history sitting right in front of us here in the radio station. I wish people could see through the radio equipment to see you guys, you know. They'd peg you as trappers.
I'd say so.
I think it would. Somebody like you guys have a tremendous time. I want to thank you for being on the show. Hope you'll come back sometimes. But
be glad to. Thank you for having us.
You bet. And we got a turkey hunt again together sometime.
Bet.
But coming up here in segment 3, Ray I will talk to Tyler Schwartz about a Conservation Federation of Missouri event coming up in just about a week. You're listening to Wild at Heart. I'm Bill Cooper from Jerry Cook. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Yes, indeed. Pass It On. Great song. It's our obligation, our responsibility, to pass it on to the next generation, our great hunting heritage. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Wild at Heart Radio. This is your handsome but yet humble guest host, Ray I. I'm going to talk to you about back in the day in the Ozarks. I recently attended the iFam reunion. I want to talk about that. But before we get into that, hey, we've got a big event coming up with the Conservation Federation of Missouri. We're going to do an interview and visit with Tyler Swartz of the Conservation Federation of Missouri. And we're going to let Tyler Swartz, the events manager, tell you all about it. Hey, Tyler, what do you guys got going on?
Hey, Ray, how's it going?
Good, brother.
Our event's coming up Thursday, September 6th in St. Louis, the Explore the Outdoors St. Louis event. It's the last stop, our tour around Missouri with the Conservation Federation. So we're going to the Schlafly Tap Room over on Locust Street in St. Louis, and it's going to run from 5:30 to 9, and we're going to have some raffles going on, meal, drinks, tours of the brewery, and got a silent auction going. And we also got our keynote presentation by Will Witherspoon. He's the, if you remember, he was the 2007 Rams team MVP, and he's actually turned into a farmer and conservationist there west of St. Louis. He's got a farm, and he does grass-fed beef and chickens and stuff, and pretty neat operation. So he's going to talk about his career in the NFL and then also, you know, his transition into being a farmer and a conservationist. So going to be fun. We're going to have several of our affiliate groups that are in the St. Louis area there. It's well as local businesses and sponsors. So you have some guns to raffle, some trips. It's just going to be a really good, fun event in St. Louis.
Sounds like a great event. I believe me and the Vogelbugger are going to come over and see you guys. What time does things get started? What time should people arrive?
So it starts at 5:30. We'll have tours of the brewery starting off then and kind of a social hour. And then we'll get into our program and dinner and drinks and stuff, and then Will's going to speak after dinner. We're going to do a live auction in there too, and should wrap up about 8:39. It's on a Thursday night. Hopefully people will be in town and be able to come out and spend a few hours with us and to network, and you know, and that's what we try and do at the Conservation Federation, is put the hikers with the bikers and the campers with the fishermen and the different groups, and bring everybody together at the Conservation Federation. So we really strive to do that, and these events are a great opportunity to do that.
Okay, how can they get information? How can they get tickets to this event?
confedmo.org/ST-LOUIS. So it's confedmo.org/St. Louis. And that's got the one-stop shop. Tickets are $75 a piece. We got sponsorship tables for a little more. For 12 people, it's $850, and gets their opportunity to get your businesses and come out and see us. If people don't understand what the Conservation Federation of Missouri is, this is a really good opportunity to get everybody that cares about the outdoors together and to spend time networking. And you know, and just even the average Joe listener that likes hiking the Katy Trail or is a hunter or a fisherman and stuff, we need members. We need all those voices that come together for one cause. And we do this at these events, and people can come out and see what the Conservation Federation does. Our website,
sure,
confedmo.org, is a great place to start.
Yeah, and they can also people get a membership from there as well, right, Tyler?
Yep. Everybody that comes to the event will become a member that night. So that's
awesome,
included in your registration fee.
All right, great. We're talking to Tyler Swartz, events manager for the Conservation Federation of Missouri. We just got an update. That's September 6th, right? Tell us again.
Yep, Thursday, September 6th at Schlafly Tap Room, 2100 Locust Street in St. Louis. Great event to come out for a good cause, and we hope to see you there.
Yeah, well, I'll see you there. Thank you, Tyler. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ray.
That was Tyler Swartz, the events manager from the Conservation Federation of Missouri. Come on down there and see us. This is a great event. These are great people. They're doing a lot of great things for Missouri. Going to change directions here a little bit. I recently attended the iFamily reunion in Potosi, Missouri. It's always a pleasure and an honor to listen to the stories of my elders, my Aunt Margie, my dad's sisters, 94 years old. And we visited for a while at the family reunion. She told me about back in the day taking the horse and wagon up on Johnson Mountain, the second highest point in the state of Missouri, to pick berries. Also talked to my Aunt Virginia, my dad's younger sister, about when they went up on the mountain with the wagon and the horse to pick berries, and a storm came in, and her and my Uncle Lee had to get up underneath the wagon. There was no place to get away from the heavy rain. What a different world we live in today. One just needs to look at Facebook and at the younger generation today. Such a change, and I know we don't want to get into I'm an old guy and back in my day type thing, but it is a different world. When I grew up, we took a lot of things from the land, as my ancestors did. And I found it really interesting when I was talking to them Aunt Margie said huckleberry, and my Aunt Virginia said blueberry.
Some of the younger folks there at the family reunion, first of all, didn't know what a huckleberry was. And when my Aunt Virginia said blueberry, that brought up some questions because most everybody there of the younger group said they thought blueberries were in, out east, and Missouri didn't have blueberries.
But actually, a huckleberry is a wild blueberry. It's also known as a deerberry, a sparkleberry, just a few of the names, and it's a low bush. They bloom and ripen over a long season beginning in April and continue through September. And what I found interesting was, if you've ever been to Johnson Mountain, well, even if you haven't been, it's rough rock up with glades, pine trees, hickory, oak, ash trees, not the kind of place you would think about picking berries. However, this low bush blueberry, or wild blueberry, huckleberry, considered the juiciest of the most flavorful berries, grows on woodlands, Missouri's rocky woodland slopes and glades at higher elevations in well-drained acid soil. So that would mean up around the glades on the side of the mountain. So that's why they took the wagon up on the mountain to pick huckleberries. Of course, my ancestors and my family used the fruit for pies, fruit spreads, sauces, muffins, pancakes, all these sort of. I remember as a kid, we picked lots of berries. I'm going to take you through some of the berries that we harvested. And I would imagine that today there's a lot of young people today don't even know what these berries are. Another one that I really remember picking as a kid and hated it was the gooseberry, because this plant has a lot of thorns on it. It's one of the earliest spring blooming edibles in Missouri. It says here it's got prickly branches. Yeah, it's got thorns on it. April and May, clusters of drooping greenish white slender flowers appear. Soon after, tiny green spears start to dangle from the thin stem. Really small berry. Now, I love gooseberry pie, and so did my dad and my grandpa and my grandma. And we pick these every year. They are just awesome in homemade pies. The gooseberry shrub grows 2 to 3 foot tall, scattered throughout much of the state. We found them back then around the edges, you know, from the timber to brushy openings and things like that. Of course, these berries can make jams, preserves, and other things as well. Boy, they could be super tart and make you pucker. And here's one a lot of you probably don't know about. Some of you probably don't know about. You older folks will. The wild strawberries. We used to pick wild strawberries close to the ground. They're a smaller berry than the tame type, but man, are they good. They have a more robust taste to them. Box turtles, that's where I always used to, when we used to collect box turtles, I always find them in the wild strawberries. The wild strawberries thrive in sunlit pastures, prairie land, rocky glades, here we go again, and open woodland slopes throughout the state. Beginning in April and May, fruits begin to turn light pink. As June rolls around, the strawberries put their familiar red color, attracts wildlife and children alike. Yeah, these are really, really good. I remember picking these. Wild strawberries yield fantastic preserves, tarts, ice cream toppings. It takes a lot of them to make a pie. And then there's wild raspberries, also known as black cap raspberry. And we always used to pick mulberries when it was right, especially a place to shoot squirrels in early summer was the mulberry trees. We used to pick those. And then something me and Jan has been talking about lately, we don't hear anybody talk about dewberries anymore. The dewberry is on a vine on the ground. It's similar to the blackberry. Man, these juicy fruits, man, they are really good. Same thing, they make great jelly, jam, and other treats. They're also, we used to eat them just, you know, right on top of a dessert for dessert topping. But my mom's favorite berry was the dewberry, as well as my grandma's. Then, of course, most everybody's still familiar with the blackberry. And I still, if you watch my Facebook pages every year, you know I pick a lot of blackberries, and they make everything, cobblers, pies, cakes, you know, pancake syrup. I like blackberry pancakes as well. There's so many things that was collected from the land. You know, walnuts in the fall. Some of you might remember putting them out on the road and running them over with the vehicle when you come in and out of the farm to get them broke down. So I had a bit of a different life back when I was a kid, because in my late teens and early 20s, I made my income from the land. I was a trapper collecting fur. We harvested anything and everything was out there, including digging roots, ginseng, golden seal. And back in the day, you'll tell you how old I am, we used to shoot a coyote and take it to the courthouse to get a reward for a bounty on the coyote. But a lot of you haven't heard about that. It was just a wonderful experience at the family reunion set, and let those folks just talk and listen to the things that they remember as kids growing up in the Ozarks and on the Johnson Mountain in Iron County. Just some really cool stuff. So there's all those things out there in the wild. And, of course, they took deer for the winter. And as a kid, you know, I was involved in the slaughter of pigs and cattle for our winter meat. Can you imagine a kid today being involved in killing a cow or a pig and getting it prepared and taken care of for the winter meat? What was really cool on the farm was in those days, they had a root cellar where they put things. Of course, they canned everything. My grandmas and aunts and uncles and everybody, they canned everything. Every type of gardens, of course, big gardens, canned all the vegetables. They canned so many different things, even canned meats. They had a spring house where they kept the milk. They milked cows. It's just a totally different, you know,
world. Everything came from the land or from the farm animals that they had on the farm for them to have food for the table. A big difference from just going to the store today. I remember back in the day, of course, they'd go once a month to the store to get, you know, certain things like flour from the grist mill and cornmeal and things like that, but everything else came from the land. Squirrel hunting was a big deal. They had big squirrel fries, rabbit hunting, quail. All these critters were taken from the field and brought to the dinner table and invite family and friends over for Sunday dinner. And anytime you went to Grandma's house, you had to eat. There was a meal. And then on Sundays and Sunday afternoons after church services, they'd have big basket dinners, and people would bring baskets of food and put it out on the table from things they took from the mountain, from the land. It was just a great time to be alive. Of course, they had a hand pump outside, eventually moved that inside. I'm so old, when I was just in grade school and going back down to my grandpa's, they were still using kerosene lamps. Great time, something that I will always remember, and just a totally different world of how people survived back in the day compared to today. And with that, we need to take a break, and we'll see you all on the other side.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart. Jerry, man, we've had an exciting program here for the last few segments, and things just got more exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I tell you what, Kenny and Randy, they're interesting people to talk to.
Oh, absolutely. I've known Randy for decades. Man, we've had a ton of fun together. But we're having some phone issues here. We're trying to get a hold of Corey Cottrell, and our phone lines are kind of messed up on us. So we're going to wing it here for a little bit. So hopefully we get
it. Yeah, nothing like watching two guys work in panic mode, you know.
Hey, we're used to it. We've spent most of our life doing that, I think. But, John, there's his phone number if you want to keep trying it. But Corey's over on Huzal Valley, you know. The
right.
Family owns Huzal Valley Resort, been there for decades. And, boy, you know, you talk about outdoors people, they're the real deal.
Not to mention a good smallmouth stream, too.
Yeah, Corey grew up right on the banks of the Huzal there. And it's just really not fair, you know. He's had a ideal life growing up there on the Huzal. And, of course, he's worked in the family business. It's not to say he doesn't work hard, but boy, I've got him in trouble more than once. Go over there to get him to take me fishing, you know. And he'll break away from about anything to go fishing. But, boy, his mama gave us a real rough time one time.
Yeah, I'm sure he works hard at that. Any family business you've got to work hard at. But I'm sure he's like a lot of us. When he plays hard, too.
Oh, he does. The thing is, his play is very targeted.
He
knows where all those big smallmouth live in the Huzal. I remember one time, probably 10 years or so ago. It was hot summertime, but we're going to float to Huzal and try to catch some fish. And, of course, you always catch fish if you're with Corey. But I'll never forget this. As long as I live, I was handling a canoe by myself, dragging it across the gravel bar there to get it shoved off into the river. Corey's already fishing. In his first cast, he caught like an 18-inch smallmouth there at the bridge, you know.
Yeah.
So I was giving him a bad time about catching fish while an old man was dragging a canoe across the gravel bar, you know.
Well, I tell you what, as long as he's lived on that stream and fished it, he sure should know it better than anyone, probably.
He convinced me that day, and this guy sometimes just comes up with the wackiest lures to fish, you know. He had an old beat-up stick bait that day. It was black and blue and silver. It looked like it had been run over by a freight train, man. I mean, it was beat up. He'd obviously caught a lot of fish on that lure. But that day, they were just all over it. I mean, he was catching a couple times, caught two fish at a time, and that doesn't happen every day.
Not every day.
But he caught well over 100 smallmouth.
Wow.
All that.
What a day.
Yeah.
That's a heck of a day with smallmouth.
Well, we had put in right at daylight, and that's the wise thing to do there. Just so that you can get ahead of the canoers. Most of the canoers don't start till about
10 o'clock or so,
yeah. And we were way down the river, probably just had a couple miles left. That's just a six-mile float. It's like 11 o'clock before the fish started catching up with us, or the canoes. So we're drifting along, and I can remember a few canoes passing us. Take your headphones off. We're working a few things out here in the studio as we go.
Iron out the wrinkles.
Yeah, we got some electrical problems going on, I guess. Did lightning strike somewhere? Nobody knows.
Well,
it's quiet in here.
It's quiet in here,
except
yeah.
Except for us talking.
Not quite soundproof, but almost.
Yeah, I want to finish my fishing story here, but I'll never forget it. About noon, I had a little yellow and black.
Hello, Corey, are you there?
Beetle spin.
I am here.
Good. All right. Bill and Jerry will be right with you in just a minute.
Man, I'm telling you, water just blew up, and I had this fish on about 3 seconds until he broke my 4-pound line. I just picked up an ultralight, and Corey says, man, that was a 24-inch smallmouth. I think he'd pull my leg.
Well, that's a big smallmouth.
I'll ask him again. Corey Cottrell?
I'm here.
Hey, boy, well, we had some problems here. I don't know if we got struck by lightning or what. I thought maybe you put a hex on us.
Well, it's not on my end. I got good phone service out here in the sticks.
Well, you sound good, that's for sure.
Yeah. It's been a little relief with the recent rains. I think it makes everybody feel good.
Oh, you bet. And you had indicated a few days ago that you'd had a little rain and the water was up a little bit in the creek?
Yeah, it did get a charge here last Thursday or Friday. Then, of course, today we got 2+ inches. So it's and it was the right kind of rain where, you know, it really recharges the whole aquifer. So we're going to have a nice floating season to end the end the summer with.
Well, hey, that's always good news, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's good for the fish and good for the fishermen and really good for the people who just want to float and enjoy the riverways.
Yeah, oh, you bet. And, of course, you guys don't have any problem drawing them in over there. You guys have been at it for decades. I guess if anybody knows how to float a boat, it's you guys.
Yeah, we keep an eye on it. But
Your old daddy started that business when? Way back in the 70s, didn't he? Mom and Dad?
April Fool's Day, 1979, was the day that they bought the property.
Wow. April Fool's Day. I'd be a little leery of that one, but it's worked out well, hasn't it, Corey?
Yep, it kind of goes hand in hand. You can do right, and it kind of comes full circle sometimes.
Oh, it does. But, hey, I got to gouge you here just a little bit. I was telling stories on you before you got on the line. I hope you didn't hear any of that. But
no, I haven't been listening.
Well, I was telling about the time we floated down the who's all there? It's probably been 15 years ago, and I'm putting a canoe in. You catch like an 18-incher on your first cast right there where the other creek, dry creek, runs into the who's all. And we went on downstream. You're tossing this old beat-up stick bait. But I think it was, black and blue and silver. Yeah. Caught like 100 smallmouth on that thing. Made me look bad that day. Caught lots of fish. But do you remember, see if you remember this, you know, you get older and years pass by, the fish that got away get bigger. Remember about noon, I threw an old black and yellow little spinnerbait up under the tree?
Spin or spinnerbait. You had like a bumblebee-colored spinnerbait, and that was your highlight of the trip because I don't think you never did lay your finger on it, but it's the one that got away.
Yeah, and how big was that fish?
I don't know. It was probably close to 18 or 20 inch fish, but it could have been bigger. I don't know. My eyesight then was better, but now, you know, you can stretch the story. It's a fishing story. You got to.
Well, I got you beat, son. I told him you told me it was 24 inches.
I thought by now it'd be up to about 30 inches. You know?
Well, hey, that's funny. That same hole of water, I caught a. Caught a 20-inch, 20-and-a-half-inch smallmouth there back in, it was Memorial Day weekend in the same exact spot. Right?
Did he have my initials on his tail fin?
I don't think so. He did. He's a different specimen, but, man, he sure was a nice one for 20-incher.
Oh, 20-inch smallmouth is sweet anywhere, but in the Hoosaw, you don't get that many of them that are that big, but man, I love going to the Hoosaw, particularly if I want to catch numbers of fish. You can catch lots of fish in the Hoosaw and some pretty respectable smallmouth. But what's going on with them now? I'm sure you've been out there and tested the water since it's come up a little bit.
Well, they've been picked on and beat on all summer. It's a little bit more difficult to trick them, but, you know, it's with this water rising, and they're going to start migrating back downstream, some of them. You know, some smallmouth, when they did that tracking study on them, you know, they're homebodies. Some smallmouth stay in the same hole their whole entire life, and some migrate, you know, up to 6 to 15 to 30 miles. You just, you know, they all migrate well, not all of them migrate, but, you know, they all like to go downstream this time of year.
Yeah, I ran into the biologist a couple of years ago on the river, and it was in October, I think, and they were doing some shocking up by Merrimack Spring. It was phenomenal, the number of smallmouth they turned up between 15, 17, 8 inches. There's like 150 of them in 2 miles or something. But they were on that migration pattern headed towards Merrimack Spring. And probably shouldn't be telling that. There'll be all kinds of people down there trying to catch them.
They're just fish. They just swim where the food goes, you know, like the sucker migration. These sucker fish, you know, I guess season starts for sucker snagging and gigging on September 15th.
Yeah, that's just a couple of weeks away.
Yeah, you know, this is prime, you know, once it gets to September 15th, that's prime time to snag. And, you know, after dark, you can gig them. And, you know, that's a delicatessen here in the Ozarks. People love to do that. And it's a nice evening out to get out of the house.
Absolutely. If you haven't had suckers fried up on the riverbank, you're not a true Ozarker. That's what you tell me, anyway.
No, but, these, you know, the fishing techniques now are varying. You know, it's prime topwater season, and, you know, they're chasing crawdads more, and, you know, it's wherever you want to catch them. You can catch them in the swifter water, and you can find out a pattern on the water. When you go, that's the key thing. You got to figure out the pattern, whether they're on a log wood structure or if they're in the rocks where it's swifter, or sometimes they're right out in the middle at the end of a pool of water where the riffle starts, and, you know, that really surprises people when they're going down a creek or a river, and you cast out in the middle of a know-nothing water, and it's at the end of the pool of water where the riffle starts. Well, that's where I catch a lot of nice fish, just being out there aggressive.
Yeah. You know, it would be amazing. People just don't realize, Corey, what ripples like that, what size fish it will hold. And as I say, if the water will cover the fish's back, there's a fish in there.
That's exactly right. They're not picky where they hang out to catch their prey, and you know that you're exactly right. They'll hang out where, as long as the water can cover their back.
Yeah,
and Jared, I could tell you I've fished with Corey enough, not near enough, but enough to know that he goes out on any of these Ozark rivers, he eliminates about 90% of the water right off the bat. So, you know, if you know where the fish are in 10% of the water,
mm-hmm.
you catch fish.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. It's eliminating a lot of that water.
Well, Corey, I can't believe it, man. We're coming up on closing time here already. We got to start a little bit late with you. Perhaps we can have you on again sometime. But, folks, hey, if you want to fish the Hoosaw, stop by Hoosaw Valley and run Corey down. Chase him down and ask him, hey, where he's catching a fish. He may lie to you, but you'll just have to take that chance. Hey, I'm Bill Cooper, and we'll be right back for Jerry Cook and myself. This is Wild at Heart.
To Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart. This segment of our show is brought to you by Advanced Performance Shooting in Waynesville, offering classes on firearms use and safety. I'm your co-host, Jerry Cook, and with me this evening is Davey Watton from the beautiful state of Arkansas. How you doing, Davey?
Right now, pretty good, thank you.
Good, good. You been getting any rain down there?
Yeah, we did, fortunately. We needed it, too.
Yeah, we did here as well, and had some good rain overnight, so that should help the water levels and should help the fishing as well. What I wanted to really kind of touch on with you here, Davey, is of course your fly fishing school that you run, and tell us about that and how you instruct people on fly fishing.
Well, you know, that largely depends to some extent. You have people that have never done it and obviously are interested in it, and you have people that have done it and they want to learn more skill levels, and then you get to people that are a little more advanced than that, and then they want to obviously improve their skill levels. So essentially what you do with students is you take them through the basic necessary factors of what fly fishing is all about, and of course that inevitably relates to fly casting. Because that's the essence of what fly fishing is, moving that fly line through the air and presenting the fly to where you want it to go, and thereafter the necessary techniques to fish that fly and hopefully get a fish to take it.
Just hope they're hungry enough to want it, right? So do you divide your classes up into, for example, teach a class on beginner level and then one on intermediate level possibly and then an advanced level class, or you just kind of pool them all together?
Yes, correct. And you may have students that want just to come for casting technique. That's one thing. And you may have students that want to come to learn nymph fishing or dry fly fishing. So there are many, many options of the different classes available, depending on what the student wants.
And of course, your origins are in Wales, I believe, and you folks were primarily dry fly fishermen there. Is that correct?
No, not really. That's kind of a little bit of a misconception here in America. Dry fly fishing really has its roots, if that's what explaining went to you, on the English chalk streams, of which they only represent, you know, a small percentage of trout water systems.
Right.
And that was largely brought about by a man by the name of Halford, and somewhat got friendly with persons over here, and they kind of did that more so dry fly fishing. But no, if you take the rest of the country, which is England, Scotland, Ireland, and pretty much the north of England, no, it was really more wet fly fishing techniques that were applied, i.e. that is fishing what we define as classic wing wet flies or spiders or soft tackles in the North Country style.
Yeah. Yeah, I personally really enjoy throwing soft tackles, but, of course, I'm known around here for throwing streamers a lot. You know, so that's kind of a joke around here is I think they take bets here in the studio when we'll start talking about streamers, Davey.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
You know, there are many techniques in fly fishing, to be honest about it.
Yes.
And the one advantage you have as a fly fisherman, if you have become accomplished at fishing all those different techniques, is that you can choose on any one given day what it is you want to do. So you want to streamer fish, you want to dry fly fish, you want to fish soft tackles, whatever. The difference is that on any given day, the behavior of the fish in relation to the techniques you're using may be negative or positive. And if that is what your pursuance is, that your intention is to catch a lot of fish, then you better have the right method or technique at that time. But if you just want to go there and spend most of the day casting a dry fly and catch two or three fish because that's what you want to do, that's okay. You enjoyed what you wanted to do. Likewise, if you wanted to fish streamers or nymphs, whatever. So one of the joys of fly fishing is that once you have accomplished skills and all the different techniques, you can choose what you want to do on any given day.
Yeah, and you're exactly right about that. And I would agree with that completely, Davey. I think you cannot limit yourself to one style of fly fishing.
Oh, no. If you do that, there'll be days when it works for you, but there will be days that it won't. And so you don't want to get stereotyped. I mean, I know people that are like that, you know, kind of locals here. And that's pretty much to them is an Ollie Woolly Bugger, and that's it, you know.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, they suffer the consequences on days where that's not what the fish want to react to.
Exactly. And you know, you mentioned soft tackles. I do enjoy throwing soft tackles. I've done my share of nymph fishing, too. I've never been much of a dry fly fisherman because, as we all know, fish, trout especially, and smallmouth bass, we do a lot of smallmouth fishing up here, feed primarily subsurface.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And also, you know, if you relate the kind of waters we have here in Arkansas and Missouri, being by generalization, mostly tailwaters, we don't get the kind of dry fly hatches that they get in western streams and eastern streams. You know, most of our fish here tend to be feeding on more crustaceans, i.e., or food places that are close onto the river.
Yes.
The exception being possibly in the early part of the year, we get really good caddis hatches, and you may get chironomids, i.e. small midges and stuff like
right.
that. But we don't get the mayflies like that they get elsewhere.
And you're correct about that, Davey. Yeah, the big mayfly hatches and so on primarily take place out west.
That's right. They do, because they're different water systems.
Entirely different, yeah. And but you mentioned the tailwater systems. For example, when I go down to Tanny Como, I figure I'm going to do one of two things, fish scuds or fish streamers that look like bait fish.
Yeah, right. I think, you know, I know we don't have all that time to talk about different things, but if you concentrate on the method of angling at any given time, based on what you know the fish are generally feeding on, then your approach is that much better for, in the long term, catching more fish. Let's put it like that. That said, even though fish are feeding on small chironomids, as we know, like little micro midges, size 18s, 20, that doesn't mean to say if you fish a streamer through some of those fish, you won't catch some.
Right.
Vice versa, same thing, whether it be dries, this, that, and the other. And it's kind of like what I said before earlier there. You have a personal choice about how you want to go and fish. And if that's what you want to do and it don't catch you many fish and you're happy, well, that's fine. And I have some customers that are like that. That's just what they choose to do. And I like fishing indicators, for example. So they're more inclined to want to fish streamers, wet flies, and or dry flies.
Yeah.
Based on what we've got conditions on the water at the time.
And you know, you mentioned indicators. I've never been much of an indicator fisherman, but sometimes it's necessary to do that.
I tell you an interesting thing about that. You know, when I learned to fly fish initially, it was in the late 1950s, we learned nymph fishing techniques, but we never used, by definition, indicators, bobbers, you call them what you will. You know, we learned relative skills of watching the line and knowing how you presented the flies in a manner that would induce the fish to take them.
Exactly, and I agree with you completely on that one, Davey. That's what I like to do. Watch the end of my fly line, and when it goes, starts moving funny, if you will, for lack of a better term, or starts to straighten out a little bit, set the hook.
That's right. The one thing I will say, in fact, it was my friend Dave Whitlock that really largely was responsible for the use of indicator-style fishing. And you cannot argue that it is an extremely effective way to present subsurface flies, i.e. nymphs, whatever, and get fish to take them, because you have points of registration, i.e. that indicator is your focus. So
right.
You can set a relative depth to the drift of the flies as based on water speed, depth, this, that, and other. And, of course, your visual indication is that indicator, and you see it stop, sink, or whatever else it does, raise the rod, and hopefully it's fish on the end.
And of course, Dave developed his own strike indicator that, frankly, if I'm going to fish an indicator, I like his indicators.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're very sensitive.
Yes.
One thing I will tell you, watching, obviously, you know, hundreds and hundreds of anglers in my time, both as customers or whatever, is that they don't tune indicators down. What I mean by that is they're not sensitive enough. They use a real big indicator with a very small fly, you know, and as soon as that fish takes that fly, it feels resistance. And the first thing it's going to do is try and spit it out of its mouth, which often it does. You have to use an indicator which is tuned to the manner in which you're presenting that fly and or various other factors related to that, so that the slightest indication that a fish is intercepted that fly, you know it instantly.
Exactly, and I think that's why Dave designed those with in three different sizes to accommodate different size flies.
Yeah, the telltale stripe indicators you're referring to.
Yes, sir, that's correct, yes. And if I'm going to fish an indicator, that's the one I prefer to fish.
Yeah, it's very, very sensitive. I think in many cases, I don't know how to explain that one, but I think a lot of fly fishermen tend to look at the easiest way out, so they use a kind of indicator where they got a stick in it or thingy bubbles or stuff like that. But they're not always the best to use. I can say that for a fact, because they're not necessarily sensitive enough based on the
right
prevailing conditions. And more to the point, you know, when you're fishing fairly shallow, slow-moving water, the first thing that fish sees normally is that indicator.
Exactly.
Or upstream. And oftentimes, it'll spook fish.
Yes.
Particularly fish that have been, you know, fished over a fair amount. So,
right.
Once again, you know, small, fine indicators of ultra-sensitivity are the way to go.
Well, Davey, I tell you what, I hate to interrupt this, but we've got to go pay some bills here, my friend, and we'll be right back with you in just a minute. So, hang in there.
I sure will.
Okay.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM. This segment of our show is brought to you by Colton Steakhouse and Grill in Rolla, where we know what's at stake. Welcome back, Davey.
Yep, I'm here.
Hey, got a question for you. I think in one of our conversations you said you had been in Arkansas for 20 years now, correct?
Yes, about that, yes.
Well, what in the world brought you to Arkansas?
Oh, everybody asked me that.
I cannot imagine.
Yeah. Well, the short answer to that is fly fishing, obviously. You know, I owned a company in the United Kingdom, in Wales, in fact, and I developed and manufactured a lot of fly fishing products, and a lot of my business was here to U.S. customers. And so I used to come here fairly often at trade shows and various other meetings and things of that nature. And when I did that, I would always go somewhere to fish, you know, whether it's Montana, Colorado, whatever, you know, stuff. And I always enjoyed it because the resources are a little different from the UK. For example, rivers in the United Kingdom essentially are right pairing. And so to get access, you have to be either a member of a club, association, or something other than that. The majority of anglers in the UK tend to fish more still water. I like man-made reservoirs stocked with fish or natural lake systems, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Dave Whitlock and myself have been known each other for a long time. We worked at fly fishing events in other countries in the world. They always used to tell me, you got to come to Arkansas and fish the White River, you know? And that's how I first eventually came here back in the 90s. And I was somewhat intrigued by this system because I had never seen a tailwater quite like that anywhere else in the world, albeit I fished some beautiful places in my time.
Oh, I'm sure.
And ultimately, to cut a long story short, I lived in Illinois for a while. Now, here, living up there, I can tell you, because there weren't no trout in Illinois. Yeah, stuff like that. And my then... wife at the time was actually from there, and well, and I had a disagreement.
Don't get me started on that one, Davey.
Well, somewhat related to my profession, hunting operations, and then I decided Arkansas is such a beautiful place. It's very much like Wales. It's very rural, and not to mention the fact that the access here to hunt and fish in this state is it's unbelievable.
You know, yes.
It really is. And so, yeah, that's essentially how I managed to get down here to Arkansas. And I love it down here. It's fabulous. It's, you know, there's about 12 deer just outside my back door in the yard right now. You know?
Yeah, and, you know, same where you are in Arkansas and the Ozarks of Missouri here, I tell you what, Davey, I've been all over this country, and this is some of the most beautiful country in the country. And not only that, as you mentioned, the access to the streams and to hunting areas and so on, it's hard to beat here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for residents of the States, it costs you in real terms, like next to nothing for those privileges, you know. And I think
yes,
that, you know, same with you in Missouri, like the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. They do a fantastic job of managing wildlife and fisheries, you know, and it really is fantastic. There's no comparison to that in the UK, that I can tell you.
Yeah, I've got customers in the UK, and I hear just exactly what you said all the time, that, you know, access to the streams and so on, if you don't belong to a club or something, you're pretty well left out in the cold, so to speak. But anyway, you've got a few DVDs out. I think you've written a few books, too, haven't you?
Years ago. DVDs probably, I think, although, to be honest about it, the market today for DVDs is just not there like it used to be, because there's just so much stuff people can pull up on YouTube and whatever else.
Right.
That wasn't the case. So I worked for Flyfish TV, and we did quite a lot of shows for ESPN at the time. And then they changed their policy so far as, you know, networking, and essentially they wanted you to pay for it, and that cost too much money. So what I did with Gene, I made a series of DVDs related to specific techniques of fly fishing, you know, whether it be wet fly fishing, whether it be nymph fishing, and fly tying DVDs and this, that, and that. And, you know, they did really well for quite a considerable period of time, but, you know, it's just that kind of market for DVD sales is just kind of not there like it used to be. And I don't know, you know, it's just times have moved on, you know. It's different to what it used to be. You imagine what it was like, you know, when we were kids back there in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, we've talked about that numerous times here. You know, Bill, my partner and buddy here, Bill's, what, Bill, 69, 70?
Yeah, 69. I'm not as old as you, Jerry.
Yeah, I know. I'm old as dirt. I'm 71, Davey, and I tell you what, you know as well as we do, things have changed a lot over those years.
Oh, my Lord, yes. Absolutely. You know, there was no such thing as watching hunting and fishing shows on the TV back then. You know, I had no computers, nothing, you know.
Yeah, you went out and did it.
That's right, yeah. You'd read books that other people had written, and of course, in the, as far as hunting and fishing is concerned, the damn bloody hundreds of them, you know? and you figured stuff out for yourself, you know? It's what you did, and I think that it gives you a background of knowledge and skill that I think, if the honesty, be honest about that, that people have got, you know, historically years behind them, tend to learn a lot more than people today who tend just to watch stuff on YouTube or whatever it is, because it's different. You know what I'm saying? It's like, well, you know, I saw that, and I said, yeah, but you didn't learn it by practical experience.
Exactly. And, you know, as well as I do, Davey, you can get good information, and you can also get a lot of bad information on YouTube.
Oh, that's, absolutely right.
You mean if it's on YouTube, it's not necessarily true?
That's exactly right, Bill. It's not necessarily true.
Well, you got a lot of stuff on there to wade through.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
You do. And you've got a lot of people today, for whatever better word, they want to be, what would you define it, like instant experts, okay? And then all of a sudden, well, you know, they got to do a YouTube thing about what they did and this, that, and other. But they don't have the years of background, practical experience, or knowledge.
Yeah. And, you know, Davey, I run into that in rod building. As you probably know, I've kind of made my niche and my name in custom rod building. And yet I've paid the price through experimenting with different materials and different techniques. And guys come along and build a couple of rods, and suddenly they're an expert, and they put a video on YouTube and trying to teach other people how to do it. And
hey, overnight heroes.
Yeah.
Hey, but, Davey, one thing maybe you haven't learned yet about the Ozarks, all you have to do to be an expert in the Ozarks is be 29 miles away from home.
And drink beer, right?
Yeah. That helps.
Yeah.
Well, Davey, I tell you what, I know you do guiding and outfitting in your area there. Tell us a little bit about what you do and how people can get in touch with you.
Oh, yeah, well, they can do that by a number of ways. They can go to my website, which is Davey Watton Fly Fishing, or they can call me direct on my telephone number, which is 870-404-5223. And so we accommodate all levels of skill, from beginners to advanced. Honestly, you know, if the truth be known, when people book you for a guide trip, they want to get an experience with you.
Yes, exactly.
Objectively, they want to catch fish. Okay. Now, some people just don't have certain skills that you need for that particular day to make things really work for them. And so it's more of an educational experience for them as well, because you're telling them, look, this, you need to do this, you need to do that, let's just control your line, things like that.
Right.
You know, not everybody is articulate. What I mean by that is there's certain skills that you have to have, if that's the way I explain it to you. And some people just don't have it as finely tuned as they should.
There are instructors out there that don't have what I call people skills, David.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would agree with that one as well. You know, I think, you know, I did a lot of examinations years ago in the UK for what we require as standards for instructors, teachers, call it what you will, you know. And part of that is not identifying, you know, the fault that the peoples have got. It's how to correct it. And in other words, what you need to do to make them more understand what it is they need to do, and then put that into practice. And you can't run before you walk. You know what I mean by that?
Yes, sir, sure do. And part of that's eliminating bad habits.
Yes, you hit the nail on the head there. Because in many cases, you have customers that have inherent bad skills.
Right.
And they're so ingrained, it is nearly impossible for them to get rid of them. And so typically, I'd have a guy call up and say, hey, you know, I want to learn to be able to cast 80, 90 foot. And the first thing I'll ask them is, well, how long have you been fly fishing? And they say, well, you know, I've been fishing about 10 years. Well, that tells me one of two things. The first one, it tells me, well, yeah, maybe they've also got some experience. But the second thing it's going to tell me, they've developed bad faults.
Right.
And
I'm sorry, man. I hate to cut you off here. But, man, I tell you what, this segment has flown by. It's been very, very interesting. It's been a pleasure having you on the program. But, man, we got to go.
You do?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. It's our time has run out.
Okay, thank you, David. Hey, coming up.
You're welcome to call me back at any other time, and we can talk further about the intricacies of fly fishing.
Fine, Davey. Well, I tell you what, we'll be in touch, and appreciate having you on.
Are coming up in segment 7, it's time for Tommy. Hey, he's quite a fisherman, quite a guy, but stay tuned. This is Wild at Heart, and I'm Bill Cooper. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart, your source of information for the Ozarks and a few points beyond. This segment is brought to you by Gar Trucking Equipment and the Outdoor Superstore, your Husqvarna dealer located on the North Outer Road in St. James, and the Missouri Trappers Associated, dedicated to preserving the heritage and skills of trapping. And we just had those guys on, and what a good job they did. It was fun to have those guys in the studio. Talk about trapping. But right now, it's time for Tommy. That's Tommy Bench.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Tommy Bench making a name for himself around the circuits now. Just won another tournament, I think. Tommy, are you on the line with us, buddy?
Yes, sir. I'm glad to be back. I missed last week. Did you guys miss me any?
Nah, we just kept on talking. We just talked fishing and cooking and all kinds of good stuff. And
it probably gave you a break from listening to me for 1 week anyway. It's probably a good thing.
We were lacking for a big fish story, though.
Yeah, but we enjoy you, Tommy. You know, it's always good for a laugh anyway.
Well, I appreciate that. I really do.
Absolutely. Well, you got to be smiling from ear to ear, man. You did get rain this time, didn't you?
Oh, hallelujah. We finally got the rain. Yes, praise the Lord. I've been wanting this exact thing for so long. You know, because that river just, it's not the same when it's real low like that. You know, the fish are like, well, it should be easier for you to locate the fish. they just don't act the same. Whenever you got that good flow, things are just so much easier on that river. They're normal.
Listen to me. I don't know about the fish, but I like it when you can float your boat.
yes, for sure. That makes it a lot more enjoyable as well. You know, like, you know, that's another thing you don't have to worry about is you don't drag. You just float through all the shoals, and awesome. This is life is so much better that way.
Absolutely. Well, I want you to tell our listeners about the this latest tournament that you guys won.
Well, the latest tournament was the last points tournament of the Gasco Sage Buddy Bassmasters, and you know, like I told other people, it's a big accomplishment in my opinion. You know, it's something
big. Well, I think
so
too.
Yep, I think so. And my good buddy Jack Uxa, he told me several years ago. He said, "Tommy, if you really want to make a name for yourself, instead of just saying I'm a guide, you know, I can put you on some fish, go there and beat the best of the best that's on that river. Go there and those guys kind of called me out on that lower Gasconade because I fish the upper Gasconade and they think it's just so easy because it's just little pressure and whatnot. So, you know, I started fishing with them back in 2014, 15, something like that. I didn't start fishing full time until 2016. But we missed two main point tournaments, and that hurt us. But other than that, we dominated. We won like six tournaments that year out of 10, I think, and 9 or 10. But we didn't win the championship. And I told Seth, I said, you know, man, the main thing I want to do this year is focus on that championship. And that's all I care about is winning that championship. And so we fished every single tournament and put ourselves in contention. We ended up having a pretty good lead. I mean, we actually won by a pretty good margin. And, you know, we went into that last tournament almost guaranteed to win, but we still had to show up. You know, if somebody had an amazing day and we didn't do anything, they could have still beat us. But we had to show up and do it. And fortunately, it was like we ended the season with a bang, with a win. I ended up catching a big smallmouth, the one big bass, and so we won the big bass money, the Cowtown money, and the big win itself, and then the championship to top it all off.
Hey, I didn't get a call to take me out to dinner.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Believe it or not, I'll tell you what happened is my life has been completely fast forwarded in the last 7 to 10 days. I've had a lot going on personally, but you know, everything's getting back to normal now, and I should start settling in. And I'd love to go out and get together with you again. If nothing else, I enjoy the food you cook on the Grub Bar.
Now, yeah, you just want me to cook breakfast for you on the river again, which I'll be glad to do.
And lunch. I was really wanting that lunch, but Milo was like, I'm not hungry.
I know, man. I had stuff in my little ice chest there for steak fajitas on the river. And these guys, John wouldn't quit fishing long enough for me to cook lunch.
I was really looking forward to it.
I was, too. I was starving to death time we got to the end of that trip. Eat that stuff raw on the way home.
Steak fajitas or fish?
Yeah.
What I would choose.
What would you choose, John?
Well, the steak fajitas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, those guys don't keep those smallmouth and everything anyway, so we'd have had to catch some perch or some crawdads, you know. And you got steak right there. I mean, it's already cut up. You throw it in a hot skillet, seared a little bit. Take that big old soft shell, you know, and put sour cream on it, lettuce, tomatoes, onions, and peppers.
Cook up some good crawdads, though, boy. And I tell you what.
You can use them for hors d'oeuvres. Yeah. That steak fajita on a river is hard to beat.
Oh, I'll bet. You're making my stomach rumble.
Well, I'm going to be cooking.
Mine, too.
If a current river don't flood this weekend, I'm going to be cooking them up Saturday evening.
Current
river, Brandon Butler and a bunch of stuff. And I guarantee you, if the river floods, I'm going to be cooking them at the cabin because we're going to be nailing cedar siding up. I think that's what's going to happen. So if we don't get to go floating, we're going to work twice as much. That's what's going to happen, Jerry.
Well, we'll still eat good. About, I got to be there.
Yeah, I'm telling you what, you got a great deal of fun. But congratulations, man, on that win and taking it for the whole season. Now, I've been hanging around those guys for the last 3 or 4 years after I started working for Cowtown. I film a lot of those events. And I tell you what, you had some tough competition there. There's some of those guys that really know how to catch smallmouth bass.
Oh, absolutely. Those guys are literally the best of the best. And a lot of them guys that fish these rivers, they think a lot of people overlook these river tournaments thinking, oh, they're just – a lot of these river guys are big sticks on the lakes too. Big Lake of the Ozark guys. And, you know, guys that go up there and win 200 boat tournaments. So it's, they're nothing to be frowned upon as far, you know, as far as their fishing abilities. They've got great fishing abilities, and they're serious about catching fish, and they're good at it. So I take a lot of pride in doing what we did and finishing at the top and beating all them other guys in the overall standings. You know, overall, that's a big accomplishment. And like, you know, as far as my guide service, that helps out. That helps, you know, that I'm not just a, hey, I'm a guide and I'll show you how to, I'll show you a good time on a float trip. You know, I have some accolades showing that I am pretty knowledgeable at catching smallmouth, and I've got a little bit of, you know, proof to show it.
I can vouch for that. Just a little bit of time that I've spent with you. And of course, I love floating with anybody that knows their area and can talk about the local history and tell me about the geographic features, the caves, the springs, and all that sort of thing. That's just icing on the cake. And of course, I mean, the real thick icing is when you catch that 4-pound smallmouth and you swing him in the boat.
Get him in the boat.
Yeah. Instead of trying to take pictures of him, you know. I've been guilty of that a lot. It's okay, you know, because you guys generally always come through and catch the fish for me. But Tommy, talking about those guys that you compete against, who are some of those guys? They're all local guys. Call some names for me. People will recognize them.
Oh, Jeff Feeler, Zach Feeler. Zach is one of my good buddies. He's a he's kind of like me. He's a big smallmouth guy where he pretty much always is targeting smallmouth. And so him and I just always got along real well. And I like to fish him one of these days. Jeff Schultz, he's considered the best out there, you know, and he's always hard to beat.
He is. He's a school teacher in Vienna. Is that correct?
I know he's a school teacher in one of them schools, either Vienna or I'm thinking it was Cuba.
I'm not sure.
Cuba.
But he's from the area. But
Owensville, maybe. Cuba or Owensville.
Could be. He's from up in that area somewhere, but knows the Gasconade like the back of his hand. He's always been a tough competitor.
He knows it well. He's the best there is.
He's got the advantage, though. He's always been off in the summer, I think.
Yeah.
That's what we'll pin it on anyway. You know, always got to pick on teachers. John used to be a teacher.
Yeah, and my wife still is.
Oh, your wife. Really John's wife is still a teacher.
I know. So she's had to put up with 3 months of vacation this summer. She gets another month of Christmas, you know. So it's tough life.
Oh, I bet that's horrible.
Oh, I know.
She has to stay home with John. What would you expect?
Yeah.
And he's picking a banjo all the time, making lots of noise.
Yeah,
sure.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, who are some of the other guys you competed against?
Let's see. You got Tim and Terry Reeves, John Sapper.
He's good.
John Sapper's a big stick. He's one of the guys I was telling you about. He's big. He's right there with Jeff Schultz. He's probably him and Schultz are the two best guys on that river. I'll just admit that right now. You know, we beat him this year, but all in all, those guys are. They put their time in. They've got a volume of knowledge. I mean, an unlimited supply of knowledge. They've had a lot of time there on that river, and they know a lot, and I respect those two individuals a lot.
So. Yeah, you bet. And you can bet they're going to be gunning for you next year, buddy.
Oh, I guarantee it will. Yeah, they will. For sure.
Yeah, I see that competition cranking up a lot, but I've enjoyed so much. I've never been a big tournament guy, but I sure get a kick out of going and filming these things, and I've discovered as an outdoor rider, that's a great place to show up at weigh-in time because these guys bring in some incredible fish, you know, like I don't see throughout the year, so it makes great photo opportunities for me and wind up often using those in newspaper articles and articles for other major magazines as well. So kind of helps get the word out there about some of these local fishermen, you know, because we do have a lot of talent on the rivers and lakes here in the Ozarks. And like I say about the old-time turkey hunters, some of the very best came out of the Missouri Ozarks. Same thing with the bass fishermen, man. Lake of the Ozarks, Denny Breyer, the first fishing athlete, I guess they call him, to ever make it on the cover of a cereal box. Big deal, Jerry.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a lot of the old-time, I say old-time, but a lot of the old original fishing TV stars came out of this part of the country.
They really did. Go all the way back to Virgil Ward. Hey, yep. Tommy, man, we need to take a break here. You know, time flies when we're having fun. You get telling fish stories and talking about other fishermen, you know. It just flies by so fast. But I'm Bill Cooper here with Wild at Heart and got Jerry Cook sitting next to me. We're going to stay right here. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back. I'm Bill Cooper, and you're listening to Wild at Heart. This segment of our show is brought to you by Salty Jack's Bar and Grill in Eminence and State Farm Insurance in Sullivan. We've got Tommy on the line. Tommy, you didn't go to sleep on us, did you, buddy?
No, I'm wide awake. I was just thinking about all the names I forgot to mention. I felt bad about it. So.
Well, yeah, tell us those names now, because, hey, we want to promote your competitors. See, we're going to pump them up. We're going to give you some real competition next year.
There you go. I'll tell you a couple of them in particular. They're real, real good friends of mine, Larry Franklin and Jeff Danielson. They're both kind of around my hometown. You know, we're pretty much locals together, and we're all the guys we fish against are more up towards that Cuba, Owensville, Rolla, kind of that general vicinity, and we're pretty much up in the upper Gasconade. So, you know, they're good friends of mine. And then, of course, the Tim Feeler that you fished with that one day, I think
great
he was in a boat
guy,
with him.
Great guy. Had so much fun with him. And, boy, he caught tons of fish. Just unfortunately,
yeah,
didn't catch any big ones. Yeah.
Yep, he's in there. He actually, I think he ended up taking third place. Him and his partner took third place overall behind his brother Jeff. Jeff Feeler, I think, took second behind me and Seth. And then, of course, like I said, you have Zach Feeler and Rob Meiser. Rob Meiser's a Cowtown guy.
Yep.
He's a good guy. Yep. And then, let's see, you have Tim and Terry Reeves. They're there pretty much every week. And then, I'm terrible with names, but I'm trying to remember all the ones that I fish with every week in and week out. And, there's Travis Cook and his son Keaton Cook. That's pretty neat. He fishes with his son. He just probably, I don't want to say, hopefully that if he hears this, he don't take offense, but I think he's only like 11 or 12 years old, but he's a younger kid.
That's great, though. He's learning. He's learning from the pros, man.
Oh, yeah. He's learning from the best of the best out there. And so it's a good experience for him. I look for him to be a guy to be a good competitor in the future, especially when he gets older and he gets a little bit more experience underneath his belt. He's going to be good.
Well, so. I bet Tommy's 15, hear him tell it, he'll be the best out there.
Oh, he probably will be. Yeah.
Hey, if he's going to all these tournaments with Dad and hanging in there and fishing for several hours, getting up before daylight, that's something to be said for a kid these days.
I'm telling you. Oh, yeah.
Hey, as far as I'm concerned, his heart's in the right place, man.
Absolutely. Yeah. Another name is Ryan Goodrich and Joel Goodrich. That's a father and son combo. Good friends of mine, too, Ryan and Joel Goodrich.
Hey, I've known Joel Goodrich for decades. I used to write for him. He had a magazine, I think, come out of Fort Leonard Wood. I don't know how many decades ago that was. A long time ago. Joel and I go way back. Great, great guy.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, I got to
real
talk.
Good guy.
Yeah, the last tournament I filmed, I got to talk with him for about 30 minutes. We did a lot of catching up, man. A lot of water gone onto the bridge, and we've both gotten old.
Older, anyway, right?
Older. No, old. Yeah, he'd had, I think, some heart surgery or something going on, you know. So we had to talk about all that stuff, you know. Us old guys, we try to encourage each other a little bit, you know. every little bit helps. Well, Tommy,
yeah, absolutely.
Now that the water's up a little bit and you're smiling big and you're happy and everything and need those clients to come and float down the river with you and have a good time, listen to the tales and everything, but are your fishing tactics going to change any now that the water conditions have changed?
Well, yes, definitely. By far, because when the water gets low, my crankbait, my square bill kind of goes away. That current really highlights certain particular baits, like a spinner bait and a crankbait. And of course, you got water temperature and you got conditions up above too. Like if it's an overcast day, for example, I took John Neperadney the other day. It's been last week, I think, and it was overcast all day long. And it was a topwater bonanza. All we threw was topwaters all day long.
I bet John liked that.
Oh, he had a blast. He had an absolute blast. He was catching fish after fish after fish. So it was fun.
Yeah, I've been in Missouri Outdoor Communicators with John for about 3 decades. And, of course, he's a Hall of Fame fisherman as well, man. Of course, he writes for a lot of the big bass fishing magazines, has for a long time. But, yeah, you won't know anything about bass fishing. If he don't know it, he knows somebody that does.
Exactly. And you know, I am so blessed to know you yourself and John Neperadney and Brent Frazee and, of course, Milo now. And like I said, I'm very fortunate to have that relationship with the group of you guys.
We feel the same way. You know, we kind of seek out the best of the best because that makes the best article material and photographs and stories and everything else. And that's not just an accident, you know, on your guys' part. It takes most often decades to turn yourself into a pro fisherman.
Not to mention right. They make good guests on a program like this as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We love having your types on the program. Makes us look good.
And that's good. I appreciate it, too. You know, it's kind of like Jack. Jack's one of the guys I really look up to. He's, you know, he's my best friend, but he's also been one of my fishing mentors. I've learned a lot from him, and I think we learn a lot from each other. And I told someone just last night, the best advice I can give anyone is surround yourself, just like we were just talking about, surround yourself by people that have the same passion and that are good at what they do. You know, they have a lot of experience and passion. It's only going to make you better.
Exactly. And, Jack, that's Jack Uxa you're talking about from Lake of the Ozarks, I assume.
Yes,
Jack Uxa. I fished with him several times. And, you know, the dilemma I've gotten into in my old age is I've dealt with so many dozens of fine fishermen over the years. And now, you know, as I'm getting into this probably last quarter of life, you know, I'm trying to crowd a lot of it in, man. And my biggest problem is deciding who I want to go with next.
Oh, I agree.
I was over just a couple of weeks ago back over at Stockton with Chris Nelson over there at Tandem Fly Outfitters. And I wish you could have seen this, Tommy. We were out, caught crappie right and left, and there was a few white bass blowing up around, and we'd speed over and catch a few of them. They'd go down. But at one point, half a mile away, we could see birds diving. We could see water splashing. It looked like 5 feet in air. We rushed over there and run right up in the middle of them with a boat. I thought they'd put them down, but there were like 3 acres of white bass hitting the top, and they stayed up for 30 minutes.
Wow.
We looked like a tuna boat. You seen those pictures of slinging fish in the boat, you know?
Yep. And
we wasn't even taking time to get them in a live well. The fish flopping all over the bottom of the boat.
That would have been a blast.
Oh, we caught them on... I had a spoon. I thought that's kind of crazy, a heavy spoon. You throw it out there and race it fast as you could crank it to get it up on top, and you can see the fish chasing it, you know, and blowing up on it. And some of the guys used a small whopper plopper, and, boy, they were tearing those things up too. But, boy, my arm hurt, you know.
Oh, I can only imagine. I can only imagine it did after all that fish catching.
Oh, yeah, that kind of spoils you in a hurry. But, see, I figured out I can make the circles over a year from one of you guys to the next, and I've always got good fishing stories, even if I don't get them in a boat.
That's right. That's a memory I'll never forget, Milo and I getting to see you catch that fish. And, yeah, it ended up coming off, but we got the memory of it, and it's pretty neat anyway.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just trying to be a nice guy. One of you guys reel that fish in and let me video. That's what I was up to, Jerry, and I let it get, get away. You should have heard them, man. Couldn't believe they talked to an old man like that.
Yeah, we forgot who we were talking to. It may have been a little disrespectful for a minute, then get it in the boat.
Hey, we all understand. We've all been there and done that, but, boy, what a ton of fun. I would trade my right arm. I would trade it, I think. Jerry's not very good anyway anymore. Trade it for those kinds of experiences. But, boy, I always look forward. You know, I don't care how good a trip is. As soon as you're done, you're thinking about the next one. And I'm sure that's how you operate.
Oh, every time. Every time I'm thinking about it is how the next time I go out and what I'm going to do and what I'm going to change, how I'm going to – you know, that's another thing that I talk to people. So many people fish history. And that's one piece of advice that I'll give anyone on any body of water. Don't fish history. You know, people are, I'm going to go to this spot because it's been a good spot before, or I'm going to do this. Well, they're not thinking about what time of year it is or what the conditions were. Fish what conditions are given. You know, if you're given, it's summertime, but since we had an overcast day, all day long it was overcast for me and John Nipradney, and that's all we did. We threw topwater because those fish don't know any different. As far as they're concerned, it's low light conditions. It's either early morning or middle of the night with just a bright moon, or that's what they do. They feel comfortable coming out and feeding on topwater.
Yeah. So, well, I'm going to see John in a couple of weeks at the Missouri Outdoor Communicators Convention. I'm going to tell him that you said he didn't catch a fish and see what he's
doing. Oh, don't do that. He won't go with me again. No, you can give him a hard time. John and I had
we
built a pretty good relationship that day and had a good time, and I respect him just like I do you and highly respect you guys in that regard. And And we're supposed to go again. He even mentioned something about crappie fishing on Lake of the Ozarks. So I'm looking forward to going to get to fish with him a little bit as well.
Oh, hey, he's always ready to go. Like I say, John's a great guy and known him for decades. And, boy, he does know how to catch the bass. But he's always looking for that different angle, you know, a little something different so he can spin off an article about it just like myself. Hey, Tommy, yeah. Man, it's hard to believe, but our time's about wound up here once again. And we've had another blast listening to you here on the show. Always great stories. Always got a laugh going on, and man, that's just what it's all about. But hey, we'll catch you again next week, Tommy. So get out there and catch some big fish. We need some more big fish stories.
Yes, sir. And I'll get him in the boat.
Oh gosh, I should have known. I asked for that. Left myself wide open. All right, this is Wild at Heart, and it's heard live every Wednesday afternoon from 4 to 6, with a repeat Sunday morning from 8 to 10. The show is produced in the studios of ESPN 107.3 in Rolla and engineered by John Francis. We'd like to thank our guests today. That was Randy Ady, Corey Cottrell, Davey Wooten, Tommy Bench, and, of course, that special guest always, Ray I. And he comes to us each week. Don't forget, you can always listen to podcasts of this show. Just go to the website at ESPN1073.com. I'm Bill Cooper, and this is Wild at Heart.
Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3, powered by Cowtown USA, Colden Steakhouse and Grill, J. Cook Fly Rods, The Outdoor Superstore, Shady Lanes Cabins and Motel, Advanced Performance Shooting, Missouri Trappers Association, Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, and State Farm agent Michelle Beckett. The latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond. Wild at Heart, 4 p.m. Wednesdays and 8 a.m. on Sundays on ESPN 107.3.